Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Monday. It's May 13th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And we're going to begin right away with John Bailey, the publisher and the editor of the White Plains Citizenet Reporter. And you could find them at WPCNR.com or WhitePlainsCitizenetReporter.com. And John is with us, and at 10:30 we'll be joined by Michael Edelman. So good morning, John. What a pleasure to have you on today.
Yes, good morning from White Plains, New York, USA, the heart of the northeast monsoon.
Oh, absolutely. Well, one thing that's almost monsoon-like, a great term, was I had no idea, and this is an article that you wrote in the White Plains Citizenet Reporter, about the expansion of affordable housing requirements approved by the White Plains Common Council, which extends affordable housing requirements across the city. And the most unbelievable thing is it's lower than income eligibility currently available by HUD. How did
right.
that happen?
It's, a real effort to make the housing available to people who need it. Like, for example, patrolmen, firemen, teachers rarely make over $50,000 a year, and that's exactly what the new minimum is, or maximum, as it should be.
Does that mean, for example, that these allocations of affordable housing requirements are going to be specific for those sort of employees, or?
Well, you have to apply. You have to apply with your various income information, and then they pick and choose.
Okay, but very, very exciting. You know what I find so compelling, or derogatory in this whole. In a whole discussion about affordable housing is that quite often we denigrate people who don't have a really good income or it's at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder when you compare to middle class, because 50,000 is not middle class, but it's certainly not the least affordable, not the least amount, but it's not enough for a city like White Plains. So most communities don't consider the fact that they need these people living in their community. They're not going to be traveling an hour to get there, and the cost is even prohibitive. So quite often you lose these people who make a city tick. And that's never
right, who actually live in it and make it a community and put more effort into their jobs because it's where they live.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's truly amazing.
And
what was the impetus for all of this? Was this Mayor Roach who was pushing and promoting it? Where did this come
yes,
from?
Yes, I believe so, because the legislation was invented by the Department of Planning's Commissioner, Christopher Gomez, who's been our planning commissioner for about 4 years now. And but there was never a real presentation of this in public. There was a presentation of it in a work session, which was televised. But be that as it may, not too many people know of its effects or understand how affordable housing actually works. And but what was also interesting is that they gave an option for developers to buy out of their affordable housing commitment, but with a caveat.
I don't know what that means. Can you explain that? Because I don't understand what that means.
A buyout means that instead of actually allotting the number of affordable housing units per year development as required by law, yet you can pay a fee in lieu of providing that housing. But the fee is rather steep.
So that means if a developer wants to build a particular facility, a residence, they could buy out these allocations for people of lower socioeconomic means. So they're not going to have an affordable housing unit for available in that residence.
Yes, that's what they can do.
So that, so
but
that's,
however,
that's
the money would be used by the city to help either build affordable housing in the city or aid people who need aid in finding affordable places to live in the city, which that has yet to be determined how they're going to use that and how they're going to actually build affordable housing themselves.
Right.
But it is interesting. I think this is the first real buyout situation that has been created in the county.
Yeah.
But it's actually an incentive because, as Jim Benaroff pointed out on my White Plains Week program that we did on Friday, if he were a developer, he'd be really concerned about whether he could rent up the apartments he buys out of fully at market rates. It's sort of a gamble for the developer. Let's face it, if he has 24 affordable housing units and say a 400 apartment building, he'd be guaranteed those rents slightly lower than, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 a month, you know, probably about $2,000 a month. And he or she would be guaranteed that those 24 units would be rented out. However, if he buys out, he invests perhaps maybe $2.9 million, something like that, $2.5 million to buy out, and then he can break even on 3 years on, say, a $3,000 apartment. However, is he going to find $3,000 a month renters for all those units? Do they detract their apartments?
It sounds like
a gamble they take.
It's
a gamble that
the
developer takes if he buys out.
No, it's not. You mean you're telling me that it's going to be a 3-year investment of waiting before you can rent all those units at an affordable rate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people will gravitate toward that because they don't want to live among people who may have a lower socioeconomic level than they. So it'll become a very exclusive, and probably you'll find them renting out a lot faster than you could imagine. Well, we'll see.
You will see, but you put it in a nutshell. My feeling is that it is to the developer's advantage to buy out.
Yes, it would be.
Yes.
But then the other question then becomes, okay, if some developers opt for that, and I think that the incentive is for them to do just that, in the studies of trying to formulate this concept, they probably realize that there will still be enough housing for those that require affordable housing, and therefore that it would still work out. And besides, they could always put a stop or put a moratorium on this if they find that they are not getting enough affordable housing units that they can be built.
Right. All they have to do is eliminate it.
Correct. So there are options all along, which is fascinating.
For the affordable housing impediment in White Plains that you have to devote some of your units has been enforced on many of the developments that have been approved, but they aren't really building them at a great pace, mainly because of financing and being able to rent up with retail as they originally planned. So, this is the whole problem with the best laid plans of mice and men. things don't quite work out the way they're supposed to.
Well, what's interesting is also in your article, you pointed out the differences between the eligibility requirements for the items that were passed by the Common Council as compared to the HUD rents, which is fascinating because, like, for two people, minimum is $50,550, but for a studio for two people would be $1,264.
Hello. I'm back.
Or a one bedroom for $1,444. That is huge differential.
Yes, it certainly is. And it points out perhaps the real problem that young people in their 20s and 30s have when balancing balancing their student debt with availability for money for rents.
Well, one thing that I find interesting, and this is it's just questionable, it's just what I realize, there was a time when there were extremely a large segment of White Plains populace were poor. And this may go back 30 or 40 years ago.
And you're
when
right.
That happened, when that happened, I think there was Al Del Bello, who became the deputy governor with Mario Cuomo. It turns out that it was, I think, before he became the deputy governor, he promoted the influx of people from White Plains to Yonkers, and they were getting affordable housing. That was specially created for people looking for affordable housing units. So the pull from White Plains to Yonkers became a moneymaker for Yonkers, but then eventually it fell apart for a million and one reasons, but particularly because there was a lot of crime because of the standards that these people had. Mostly because they couldn't get employment in Yonkers. So it was very difficult for them, even though at affordable housing rates, to really make a go of it. And it also diminished the city, and then eventually they weren't making money off the government in that case. Is it conceivable that you're going to now get a reverse by trying to make housing affordable?
Well, yes, I think so. But what is happening in White Plains from a population standpoint is that the African-American population is dwindling. It's now under 12%. And the Latino population is expanding.
Right. Well, the birth rate among people of Hispanic heritage is much greater than those of the African-American community. I don't know why. It's also, I tend to think there's also a younger population of Hispanics than there are of African Americans. And there are a lot of people that are African Americans that moved down south. They were from there originally, and they're moving back for affordability and maybe for some other reasons that I'm not aware of.
Stat, the school district last week, that it appears that the for the first time in a long time, the number of white enrollments in kindergarten is up.
Really? And why? And what do they?
They don't know exactly why.
Do they rationalize it, or they don't know?
Happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
you know what?
And the
it
also
that
the,
if that's the case,
not losing a lot of people to private schools either.
Well, if that's the case, and you have a larger enrollment of white students in the White Plains schools, it means that you have young people who are already having a child or two, and they are moving into a successful, magnet, which turns out to be the city of White Plains. So evidently, it's a concept that's working.
The school district is doing a good job.
okay? And therefore inviting
being,
people to come in and move.
Yes. And
there are also job opportunities in White Plains that are not available in so many other cities. You have basically a population in White Plains. It's a very unique city. A population in White Plains of between 50 to 60,000 people.
Right.
That's at night. They sleep. And then in the day, it balloons to five times that, to 250 to 300,000 people, and they all come to work. So
absolutely.
The opportunity for employment is there.
White Plains has a rush hour now.
Absolutely. It's absolutely, I don't know if they figured this out originally or if the city was, you know, a bucolic sort of place originally, and then it turned over because more and more businesses came there, or that White Plains invited all the business people to open up there.
Well, remember the Miracle Mile years when all those corporate headquarters were built out along Westchester Avenue. Well, that has now, there are a lot of vacancies out there in those office buildings. And I think most of the employment now is in the downtown of White Plains. I mean, we have the office buildings.
It always is.
Yeah.
It always is. It's just that people thought that they could get away with doing something different, and it didn't work. The template
it worked
is exactly
for a while.
That, downtown.
Worked for a while. But now it is turned around.
But working for a while is not proficient. It's that simple.
Yeah.
We
also learned.
People like to experiment.
Yeah. We also learned from Robert Weiss, who got his 1133 Westchester Avenue mixed-use apartments and office building complex approved last week. He told us in an interview that office space is now really at a premium in Westchester. It's selling out. He says he has never hit 100% of his office buildings are rented out. And he just can't offer space. And so that was a good sign. Westchester is growing.
Well, it definitely is, but basically you're saying that White Plains is growing, and White Plains is the one that's the recipient of either planning or they just fell into it by accident, but I think it's a lot of it has been planning.
What have you got? It's on a rail line that is the best railroad line of the three. There's virtually no crime in White Plains, virtually no crime.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the violence.
Mm-hmm.
And the school system is terrific. And the more I complain about how expensive it is, the better it seems to get.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the only challenge now is getting a fair shake as far as businesses that open up and sell products, at a brick-and-mortar store, as opposed to getting revenue from the online, operations that don't pay a return to the cities. But maybe that's going to change as well now. So it looks like White Plains is really at the cutting edge and probably the leading community in all of Westchester County, which is interesting.
Well, since I always look at things with the very look at White Plains generally. Well, how can White Plains improve? What are we doing wrong? Always the journalist's standpoint, you know what I'm saying? But in retrospect with the other communities around Westchester, our taxes are stable, and this is really an attraction for people seeking to move here. And it also gives them, with this new affordable housing initiative, you will get hopefully an influx of a very good racial mix into those affordable housing that also, have the ability to pay the rents and stabilize the building, and also make a more coexistent population in the buildings that are planned here. Mm-hmm. There, I think right now there are about 7,000 apartments planned for the city. All that mm-hmm. is awaiting is the financing and the renting up of the mixed-use portion, the retail mm-hmm. and the various other businesses. Mm-hmm. And the grid properties... Grid Properties says they are moving ahead and starting to lease up. That's the property at the west end of town on East Post Road, right before Scarsdale.
Well, so it looks like things are really going to be popping over the next year or two as all these developments, get built. It shouldn't
take
too much longer.
Yes, move along. They have to move along. But they are staggered, as I mentioned last week, because they're not all going to be finished at the same time.
Right, which is perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it should be. Excellent. Well, that should be a step up for Mayor Roach to be reelected. You know,
well,
there is
no opposition to Mr. Roach in White Plains. Even the candidates that are running for Common Council are not even appearing at the Common Council meetings and mm-hmm. making perhaps constructive criticism of some of the projects.
He's showing that it works. I mean, his guidance is working.
Campaign.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Well, just a campaign for the sake of campaigning and creating issues that don't exist, certainly it looks like under Roach's administration, he's shepherded to the majority, much which will make the city successful. So you've got the development, you now got housing that's affordable for people that could never afford before in a city that's growing and vibrant. It doesn't get better than that. Show me another city that's doing the same thing, and then I'll just about ready to croak. It's not out here in Westchester County.
Right, and the buyout is actually a mm-hmm. stroke of genius because it's not as litigatable an issue. No one has ever challenged uh-huh. the affordable housing legislation, but you might mm-hmm. see it being done. But the buyout immediately pulls the plug on that type of legal action. I've always been surprised that no one has ever taken the affordable housing legislation into court.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one other thing. This weekend, you had, Standard Amusements open up?
Yes. Well, the county opened up. And they had mm-hmm. an absolutely spectacular day Saturday. If they didn't fill up that park, and we don't know whether they did or not, there was did you see anything on News 12 or anything like on the Playland opening Saturday? I didn't.
I don't watch News 12 because I don't live in the city, so I don't have the ability to access it, and.
Right.
You know, but, so I guess if they didn't cover it locally, then I guess it wasn't.
Like Sunday had to be a washout because it rained all day, so you didn't get good attendance Sunday. But if you got a great crowd at Playland on Saturday, the opening day, which was pretty much heralded, and you got to be concerned. So we'll see if they release those numbers, which I have asked for, and see.
All right.
But be that as it may, Playland has had. I mean, Mr. Latimer went on Fios One on their Newsmakers program, and once again went over the Playland situation that it is safe and that all the charges by Standard Amusements were bogus, and they've complied with virtually all the criticisms that were made about food service and sanitation and all that. And he also said that they would be probably looking at other organizations or persons to run it and put out requests for proposals.
Mm-hmm.
And what does this do? This means it pushes Playland farther out. You know what I mean? As far as really making a change there?
I do.
If you requests for proposals are very convenient because it takes a year for them to be responded to, and then they have
mm-hmm.
to pick somebody, and by that time, election rolls around.
That's true, too. Want to ask
yeah.
you about one other thing, Max Cali. They had this property at 1 Water Street. It's now planning to become 300 apartments. So
yeah,
you've got a so you know a home and apartments are really hot in White Plains. I can't say that about Yonkers. That's for sure.
Well, this is the first real indication of a apartment dwelling right next to the train station.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting. So we await the city's pick of the request for proposals that they put out
mm-hmm.
to develop the 4 city-owned parcels right alongside the railroad tracks there at the present Metro North station. That's my
That's
point
good.
About request for proposals that I made earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time when you do things that way.
Right. But is there another methodology other than that?
Well, you can't be criticized if you put out requests for proposals and you say, well, we think this is the best one. And
mm-hmm.
if you recall, years ago, Louis Capelli was willing to do a study of what could be done down at the train station for $3 million. And
right.
if he was given the right to develop it.
Right.
They rejected
that.
And here it is. It is, let's see, 12 years later, and that station is looks just the same as it does before, except for some signage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when
right.
you do not grab the opportunity, it goes. However, that was a political decision. The council makes lots of political decisions in White Plains, which come back to haunt it.
Hmm.
That's been their history.
Well, who knows? I mean, there's no point in speculating why those things happen, but they do. Sometimes I really wonder if the common council or the city council, depending on where you are as informed as the mayor, and or if they really share enough information so that, you know, you've got really credible, intelligent deductions and therefore outcome.
They don't ask enough questions at the time. They don't press issues. They're timid.
Right. There's a tremendous amount of timidity. That's an excellent word. Excellent. Excellent, John. Well,
right.
John, any last words as we approach the last minute?
Well, things seem pretty quiet heading into the summer. We anticipate probably some sort of action on the 52 North Broadway project up on the Good Council property in White Plains, which is another developing situation which might go on for some time. And the developer there is protesting that this is taking too long. And this is what happens. The neighbors are very vocal in White Plains. They do a lot of research. They're very smart, and they really a lot smarter than the Common Council, by the way. they raise questions that the Common Council should have asked on many projects. Yeah.
Well, John, unfortunately, on that note, we have to go. Have a great week. All the best.
I will try.
Excellent reporting at White Plains CNR. That's really, really fantastic. All the best.
Thank you. So long, everybody.
Be well. Bye. Well, I see we've already got our guest of all people. It's Michael Edelman. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Ashley. How you doing?
All right. Thank you for joining us today. It's a great way to start off the week. Always with you on. One of the interesting issues that came about that I was reading about is that the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she suggested, it seemed, or a big inference, that the president could block Robert Mueller from testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. And because of that, the speculation is that the Attorney General, William Barr, is going to order the special counsel not to testify. And now we're hearing that maybe Mueller will resign in order to avoid being forced into that situation. Have you heard, or can you validate that? Is that what's happening, and why is it?
Well, Adam Schiff last night said that Mueller will testify. And the only reason that Trump is able, or Sarah Sanders is able, to make that statement is because technically Bob Mueller is still on the payroll of the Department of Justice, and so he works for President Trump, technically. But as soon as that relationship is over, there is no way for Trump to stop a private citizen from testifying.
Absolutely. So in a sense, Mueller is going to be able to protect himself and also get the issues out there in the forefront. It will be a major challenge to the president. Another thing, too. Go ahead.
Mueller did not intend for Bill Barr to characterize his report in a four-page summary that tended to be favorable to Donald Trump, when if you read the Mueller report, everything in it is damning about what Trump did to obstruct. There were 800 former prosecutors the other day that signed a letter that said that if Trump was not protected by the Office of Legal Counsel policy, that a sitting president couldn't be indicted, he would have been indicted for obstruction of justice. 800 of them. 800 former federal prosecutors. That's enormous. And so the end game here is very simply for Mueller to appear. This is going to be the most watched television drama since MASH went off the air, because everybody is going to be tuning in. Those who read the Mueller report, those who didn't read the Mueller report, to find out what Bob Mueller thinks of his own report and his own evidence, because we didn't get to see that. We got a redacted version, and we got an interpretation by an attorney general who's acting as the president's lawyer rather than acting as the lawyer for the people of the United States of America. So this is going to be extremely riveting.
I think so. It will be the number one show of the year, which I guess is just right up President Trump's alley, because, you know, he's the consummate showman. So we'll see how he comes out of it. We'll have to see. Well, you know, not everything is hunky-dory, and not everything is going to be on TV. But one of the big issues, evidently, with President is that he's embroiled in a tariff war with China. The stock market is going down. There's a torrent of fear that we might go into a recession. Already, China has responded to by imposing some tariffs, but it's not like an outright fight yet. Is the president going to be able to control what's going on here with China, or is he on the losing end here?
He's on the losing end, and let me tell you why. His premise is false. His premise, and what he's been telling the American people over and over and over again, is that the Treasury of the United States stands to gain $100 billion from the imposition of tariffs on Chinese goods. That is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday's interview by Chris Wallace with Larry Kudlow revealed that what's going to happen is that the American consumers are going to pay higher prices for anything made in China that they need. It will cost the average family $2,400 a year. We're going to lose 2 million jobs. GDP is going to go down by a half a percentage point, and we'll probably have a recession and stock market crash, all of which is terrific as far as I'm concerned, because it proves that Trump doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
Well, based on the last sentence as well, he's got troubles with Korea. They're shooting short-range missiles that evidently are, photos of them are suggesting that they're Russian missiles. And then there's a problem with Turkey as well. They were going to originally buy F-35 jets, and then America said no. They're not going to sell it unless they capitulate to this, that, or the other. And now the Russians are involved, and they say, well, if you don't have the opportunity to buy American jets, you can buy our jets that are just as good. What's going on here? Is he picking too many fights? Because it doesn't seem like he's going to be able to, you know, balance them all up in the air.
Trump is attempting to bully, which is his MO, other world leaders who are not susceptible to bullying. Trump said after he met Kim, you no longer have to worry about a nuclear attack. And he was wrong because Kim hasn't changed his position. If anything, he's moved closer to being able to attack South Korea with these very quick, very agile short-range missiles. President Xi is president for life. He doesn't have to worry about his GDP going down because he can't be removed. The Chinese model is a subsidization model. The only thing China really is doing that is concerning is they're stealing technology and they're forcing firms that do business in China to hook up with a Chinese company so they can steal proprietary information. That has to be dealt with, but you don't deal with that by bankrupting your farmers because they can't sell pork and soybean. You don't deal with that by imposing tariffs that are paid for by American consumers. Trump doesn't seem to have gotten much of an education in Wharton. And I should point out, he didn't go to Wharton Graduate School. I got in. I chose to go to law school, but Trump couldn't have been a very good business student in the undergraduate portion if he doesn't understand that tariffs are paid for by people who are buying the goods.
Right.
That's who pays for it. And as long as he has that lack of policy understanding, he's going to make mistakes. And as long as he makes mistakes, guys like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping are going to take advantage of his naivete. And so he's biting off more than he can chew. I should note, he doesn't have a Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
The cabinet position is vacant.
Yes.
So how is he getting involved in all these military endeavors with Iran, threatening Iran, sending a carrier group to the... You know who's going to get wiped out? Israel. If we attack Iran, they're going to attack Israel. And I don't care how many iron domes Israel has. If Iran attacks Israel, Israel's going to have to counter with the use of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. So you think, so where are we going to go? Because now Iran is saying since the Americans pulled out of their agreement, they're looking to Europe to bolster their efforts. Otherwise, they're going to go and become a nuclear power. And they're giving the 60 days notice.
The interesting thing about the Obama-negotiated nuclear agreement was that Iran was not in violation of it.
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting thing is that virtually every Israeli retired defense official thought that the deal was good. It's the Republicans didn't like the deal because it was negotiated by a black president. And they kept screaming that they were giving money away when, in fact, that money was Iranian money that was frozen in 1979. So they got their own money. They didn't get any money from the United States. So all of that was Fox News nonsense. And Europe knew that Iran was abiding by its deal. It would have pushed off for 10 years their ability to get a nuclear weapon, and who knows what's going to happen in 10 years in terms of Iran. So now we've got a quasi military confrontation where, you know, Trump is threatening Iran based on we don't know what, because we don't know what American facilities they were threatening. And this is the kind of situation that could rapidly spiral out of control. I point to World War I and the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand by Gabriel Princip. Nobody expected a war, but guess what? That's what they got.
Yeah, exactly. And you were talking about before about technology. Is America capable of winning this war against Huawei's telephony and routing systems, which are strategically are very, very important, especially with the 5G fiber optics capacity? But supposedly the routing systems can actually grab and get information from what's being funneled through those routers. And so did we make a mistake with Huawei?
We make a mistake with everything.
Company in the world.
No, but Trump doesn't know how to negotiate. You don't negotiate publicly. You sit down and you negotiate privately. You don't make demands on foreign countries publicly and then force those countries not to be able to come to the table because they don't want to lose face. You go to a diplomatic bargaining table, you make a deal, and you both spin it to look like you won. You don't allow Trump to go out and pound the desk and say you will do this and you will do that, or you will face these punishments and these sanctions and these tariffs, because they're not going to be intimidated.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I don't know where it's going to go. Well, what about the other thing? It seems can we say that the president is doing well in any realm, or is he floundering? And are the Democrats floundering, or are they getting some headway? Because I hear there's talk about that the Democrats may not be making the points that are necessary in order to undermine Trump, because they're not coming up with ideas yet that are somehow working out for
for the
Democrats or the Republicans.
Yeah, well, there are 21 or 22 Democratic candidates, some of whom are talking about climate change, some of whom are talking about the Green New Deal, some of whom are talking about Medicare for All, some of whom are talking about all different kinds of things. So there isn't one coherent Democrat who's able to articulate the Democrat position on a whole bunch of issues. Now, there was a poll that came out this morning that was conducted among Democrats in South Carolina, which is one of the first three primary states after Iowa and New Hampshire, and whose demographics more nearly represent the demographics in the Democratic Party nationally. And Joe Biden had 46%, the Bernie's 15%.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
So,
my God, those are huge.
Yes.
Wow.
So what's going to happen, the Democrats who are led by Nancy Pelosi in the House don't want to impeach Trump, even though the number of people in the United States that want to see impeachment is now at 45%, believe it or not. It's up 6 or 7 points from last week. But the process has to go on to where a couple of things become apparent to Trump voters, voters who are not sycophantic Trump voters, voters who said in the 2016 election, well, you know, we don't like Hillary Clinton, we don't like the foundation, we don't like the fact that her husband is getting all these speaking fees and she's getting, and so let's take a chance on this so-called business genius, and maybe he can run, you know, the government like he runs his business. Well, it turns out He lost $1 billion from 1984 to 1993. He lost more money than any other individual in the United States. So he's not a business genius. So those people whose view of Donald Trump is less than solid have to be shown slowly and surely by the hearings and the evidence and the testimony, including that of Bob Mueller's, which has revealed in the Congress how he's cheated on his taxes, he hasn't given any money to charity, he has Russian money from oligarchs through Deutsche Bank, Russians bailed him out by buying his condos, he obstructed justice by instructing Don McGahn to say something that wasn't true, which is that he didn't obstruct justice, and Don McGahn refused to do it. Bob Mueller will testify that, yes, he'll testify, yes, Trump committed obstruction, and the only reason we didn't proceed was because we were prevented from proceeding, and what we recommended was that a future prosecutor could proceed, and so could the Congress on impeachment. We did not intend for William Barr to obfuscate our conclusions. And he can also testify that as to the so-called exoneration from conspiracy, that there was evidence that Bob Mueller could not get his hands on because either it was encrypted or witnesses disappeared. They went to Europe and they couldn't find them. So it's still possible that Trump's people conspired. So we don't know why Paul Manafort, for example, showed Konstantin Kilimnik the internals of the Trump polling. We don't know whether Cambridge Analytica worked for Russia and micro-targeted Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania voters. We don't know whether the Trump campaign was fully aware of it. And because even if that's not illegal, it's certainly unethical, and it's certainly nothing that even Trump voters would want to see. We know that they welcomed Russian intervention, and we know that the campaign expected to benefit from Russian intervention. Mm-hmm. And that's not any way that an American presidential campaign should be conducted. So the fact of the matter is that all of this will be laid out slowly and surely in the Congress. And once that happens, I suspect that the number of people that will favor impeachment will go to 60%. And then Republicans will start breaking away from President Trump. And if that doesn't happen, it won't make a difference because he's not going to get reelected.
So I guess we just have to be patient to await the Democratic response to the president.
Right.
And so we just need to wait longer. I guess I just wanted to hear some ideas.
Right.
Okay. So legislative wheels, it's going to take some time. One of the things
they grind exceedingly slowly.
Yes, very much so. One other thing that came up with regard to trade negotiations, South Korea is engaged in a last-ditch appeal for its car industry, and they're sending one of their representatives to lobby for South Korea not to be hurt badly by these tariff wars that are taking place. Does the president even recognize that what he's doing is really he could destroy the economy in South Korea?
He doesn't recognize what he's doing, period. And Larry Kudlow demonstrated that yesterday when he was nailed by Chris Wallace. The president lies. He lies on a daily basis. He's had these beliefs about tariffs for 40 or 50 years. He's 72 years old. He's not going to change his mind. He's not going to listen to experts. He's not going to do anything but what he wants to do. And that's what the framers of the Constitution were thinking about when they made Congress and the courts a co-equal branch, and they gave to the Congress through the Constitution the responsibility of oversight, because they understood that one day we might elect somebody who thought he was a king, not a president, not a Democratic president.
Yeah.
And that's what we've done.
Well, another thing that's really, really important is this whole issue with the Boeing MAX planes that were grounded based on safety requirements that evidently they didn't meet. So the Boeing 737 MAX, and evidently that's going to come before the Congress. They're going to investigate what went on, and I think the FAA is convening on May 23rd. With other regulators. Is this greed that was evident by Boeing, is that going to undermine our manufacturing capacity? Are we going to lose out to the Russians and the Europeans? This is huge, isn't it? This is going to really affect us quite a bit.
Well, you know, Boeing did what they shouldn't have done. They made it optional. A piece of equipment on their 737
yeah.
MAX that would tell whether their sensor was
mm-hmm.
giving the right information to the pilots. And as a result
yeah.
of their failure to simply include it as part of the package of this very
yeah.
expensive airplane, they caused negligence. They will be sued. They caused the deaths of almost 600 people. And that was through
yeah.
corporate greed and rushing, failing to redesign an airplane because they were competing with Airbus, who had this brand
yeah.
new airplane, the A320, and they didn't want to sit down and redo the 737. So they simply reconfigured the engines, and they got this
yeah.
problem where the sensors would force the nose of the plane down. And
yes.
if you didn't have this piece of optional equipment, you wouldn't know that those sensors were given wrong information, and the automatic pilot system had to be disengaged in order to right the plane. And that didn't happen
yeah.
in those two crashes because they had to read the manual while they were in the cockpit, and they had about 10 seconds to do it. So
mm-hmm.
Boeing should go out of business, as far as I'm concerned. You cannot have an airplane manufacturer that does that. And if they don't go out of business, they should be fined substantially. They should be regulated by the FAA and not themselves, which was part of the problem. And,
right.
and they should be forced to pay damages to the families of who lost loved ones in those two crashes because it was a typical case of negligence.
Unbelievable. One other thing about, Notre Dame, the cathedral that burned. I've been reading reports, and I don't know who to believe. Some people say that the wood that was there for so many years is petrified wood, and it wouldn't have burned if there wasn't an accelerant that was used there, and that there was no electricity that was engaged in that section of the church. How does one recognize what is or what isn't? And what was interesting is that when Notre Dame was burning, before even the fire was extinguished, the government in France said that, hey, there's no plot here. This isn't some sort of terrorist action. How do we get around all these sort of concerns that may be important and may not be?
There have always been conspiracy theorists that emerge from under a rock after there's a tragedy. After 9/11,
yeah.
they were claiming it was an inside job. After Kennedy was assassinated, they were claiming it was the CIA.
Right.
After Parkland and after at the other site of the school
shooting.
They claimed it was fake.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
there's always going to be this nonsense. But normally, in an arson, if you're going to start an arson in a site like Notre Dame, you're not going to do it in the roof. You're going to do it
mm-hmm.
downstairs. So
uh-huh.
it burns the entire thing to the ground, as I understand it. They have identified
mm-hmm.
that there was an electrical shortage in the equipment that was being used to restore Notre Dame, and that's why the fire was in the upper, because that's where the equipment was. They were restoring the wooden panels, so I don't believe that there was any accelerant used in this at all. That wood, in fact, it was wood. It wasn't petrified wood. It was wood, and it was of the kind of wood that could easily burn. And so any fire that started, and plus, I believe the initial reports were the fire wasn't really a large fire when it initially started. And it spread because of the nature of the wood that was in the top of the cathedral. So I don't believe for a moment that it was conspiratorial or that it was arson.
Interesting. Yeah, because I just didn't know where to go with all of this. One other thing that's really important is Venezuela. Sorry, go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Go to Venezuela.
I want to ask you about Venezuela. Evidently, Maduro is going to try to prosecute those people that were backing the uprising. And what can America do about it? Or have we already lost the capacity to change a government there? And should we have even engaged in it in the first place then?
Well, other than jawboning the situation and saying that we support Guaido, there isn't really anything we can do. We're not going to send the military there. And the military is not on Guaido's side. They're apparently on Maduro's side because the generals are all getting paid off in one way or another. So there's very little we can do in Venezuela to change that situation. Plus, Russia has 100 troops there, and so if we invade Venezuela, we're going to be in a military confrontation with Russia. But the fact of the matter is that, again, Trump is doing this stuff publicly, and he should be doing it privately, and that's one of the keys to his failure. He's telegraphing his blows. He's swinging from the from the hip. He's shooting from the hip. He's not a foreign policy expert when he comes to conclusions. He's doing it all by touch, just taking those books and everybody else. And he lost to get mad at him. He lost a guy he knew when he was there. And now he's taken. Emperor has some clothes. One policy takes him to the other. The thing is not like my
unfortunately, Mike, we're losing you, so it hasn't been corrected. Oh, that sounds a little bit better, I think.
All right.
Oh, that's better. No, that's cool. So, was this a big mistake on a foreign policy mistake? Is it conceivable that Trump will have also lost all those people that fled Venezuela and moved into Florida? They're not going to be voting for the president if he's going to have lost an opportunity to change the government from Maduro to Guaido. Is that really on the block, so to speak?
He's got other problems that are far more serious in Florida in terms of Joe Biden, who's extremely popular in Florida, and he's got a million felons that were overwhelmingly granted the right to vote in Florida. And the Florida state legislature is attempting to put a roadblock up to their ability to vote by passing the equivalent of a poll tax. In other words, they have to pay everything they owed in terms of restitution for their crimes and fines and all of that before they get the right to vote. But that'll be challenged in court, and they'll lose. So he's got a lot more to worry about in Florida than the small number of Venezuelans that might be in this state.
Amazing. Well, there's so much that's already happened, and who knows what will happen by next week. Pompeo also stopped off in Brussels today. What was the purpose of that? Is there some sort of a problem that we had that he changed his route?
I have no idea.
Okay. We're going to have to find out more. Probably later on in the week we'll find out. So maybe we'll talk about it next week. Thank you so much, as always. All the best.
You're welcome. You too.
Thank you. Bye. Well, there we have it. None other than Michael Edelman, the political analyst. Just brilliant. So aware and so well studied on all these fronts. So very, very encouraging to say the least. Now, let's just quickly look and see what else is happening around the world. Wanted to find out what's going on with Sweden. Evidently, Sweden is reopening the rape probe against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. So Swedish prosecutors today said they were reopening a 2010 rape investigation against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, hoping to bring him to justice before the statute of limitations expire in August of 2020. So the 47-year-old has claimed the Swedish allegations were a pretext to transfer him to the United States, where he fears a prosecution over the release by WikiLeaks of millions of classified documents. I have today decided to reopen the investigation. There is still probable cause to suspect that Mr. Assange committed rape. Mm-hmm. The deputy director of public prosecutions, Eva Marie Persson, had told reporters. Now, the previous decision back in May of 2017 to close the investigation was not based on difficulties related to evidence, but on difficulties that blocked the investigation. The Australian whistleblower, that's Assange, who holed himself up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years to avoid a British extradition order to Sweden, was arrested on April 11 after Ecuador gave him up. London court sentenced him on May 1 to 50 weeks in jail for breaching the British order. Now that he has left Ecuador's embassy, the conditions in the case have changed, and I am of the opinion that the conditions are in place once again to pursue the case, the prosecutor said. Persson said she hoped Assange could be questioned again in the case. She said he would soon ask a Swedish court to remand him in custody in absentia, and a European arrest warrant would be issued. So Assange's spectacular arrest revived his Swedish accuser's hope of seeing him behind or brought to justice, and her lawyer asked prosecutors to reopen the rape investigation. The alleged victim, who says she met Assange at a WikiLeaks conference in Stockholm, filed a complaint in August of 2010. She accused him of having sex with her as she slept without using a condom, despite repeatedly having denied him unprotected sex. Assange has always denied the allegations. His website editor, Kristen Raftenson, said on Monday the reopening of the investigation would give him a chance to clear his name. And Raftenson had said in a statement that there had been political pressure on Sweden to reopen the case. With the Australian and the Ecuadorian embassy, the Swedish case dragged on for years over procedural difficulties, and prosecutors were never granted permission to question him directly. In testimony released in December of 2016, after an Ecuadorian prosecutor grilled him over questions supplied by Swedish prosecutors, Assange insisted the sex was consensual. In May of 2014, Sweden's Director of Public Prosecutions, Marianne Ni, decided to close the preliminary investigation into the rape allegations. She argued that since Assange could not be reached after taking up residence in the embassy in London in 2012, it was not possible to proceed with a probe, but left open the possibility that it could be reopened if Assange were to become available again. So the statute of limitations on the rape allegations expires on August 17 of 2020. If the legal process drags on past that date, then the case would have to be closed, the prosecutor said. In 2015, Swedish prosecutors dropped a separate sexual assault probe into Assange filed by another woman, after the 5-year statute of limitations expired. So Assange's biggest concern, however, remains an extradition request from the United States, where he is wanted for hacking. And that extradition request was only revealed following his dramatic arrest in London when police dragged him out shouting from the embassy. A U.S. indictment charges him with conspiracy for working with former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning to crack a password stored on Department of Defense computers in March of 2010. Manning passed hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, exposing U.S. military wrongdoing in the Iraq War and diplomatic secrets about scores of countries. Assange could face up to 5 years in jail if found guilty, although his team is fighting his extradition and the process could take years. The change has raised serious concerns about free speech advocates. Among free speech advocates, and the Swedish prosecutor said that if Britain were faced with a conflicting European arrest warrant and U.S. extradition request, it would be the British authorities' prerogative to determine which has priority. So, my God, the stuff that goes on, huh? There's always something happening all over the world. Well, one thing is interesting. 1 second here. Where is it? I'm looking for 1 minute. 1 second. I was looking for. Where is it? 1 second. Okay, I thought I had something here, but evidently not. I wanted to quickly go back to what's happening on the international stage. So bear with me a moment. Evidently, something's going on in the Philippines, and the Philippines are voting in an election expected to deliver greater power for Duterte. Filipinos head to the polls today in a move that is expected to strengthen President Rodrigo Duterte's grip on power, opening the way for him to deliver on pledges to restore the death penalty and rewrite the Constitution. More than 18,000 positions are at stake, including half of the seats of the Upper House Senate, which has served as a bulwark against some of Duterte's most controversial policies. Duterte is known internationally for his foul-mouthed tirades, but remains hugely popular among Filipinos fed up with the country's general dysfunction and leaders who have failed to fix it. He wants to bring back capital punishment for drug-related crimes as part of the deadly crackdown on narcotics, in which thousands of suspects and drug addicts have already been killed. His tough-on-crime platform, which also includes lowering the age of criminal responsibility from 15 to 12, was key to his landslide election victory in 2016. Voters crowded voting centers in the capital of Manila ahead of polls opening at 6 o'clock in the morning in the election, where some 61 million people are registered to cast ballots. I voted for many of the candidates endorsed by President Duterte because his government is doing its job, said Mirna Cruz, who's 51. I support their programs, including the anti-drug campaign, but I wish the bloodshed would stop, she said, echoing many Filipinos' nuanced backing of the crackdown. Historically, the nation's 24 senators who served 6-year terms have had a reputation for being more independent-minded than the lower house. Winning a Senate majority, something that independent national surveys indicate is well within reach, would give Duterte legislative backing for his anti-crime proposals and his plan to rewrite the Constitution. So the opposition warns that that could lead to the single-term limit for the presidency being lifted, allowing him to seek re-election despite his repeated statements that he would stand down at the end of his mandate. It would also allow him to expand his contentious anti-drug crackdown by bringing back the death penalty, a pledge that the United Nations Human Rights Council said gave a deep alarm, quote unquote. The Philippines outlawed capital punishment in 1987, reinstated it 6 years later, and then abolished it again in 2006. A 74-year-old, hit the campaign trail to get his supporters in the Senate, giving two-hour speeches at late-night rallies and routinely insulting their opponents, calling one a faggot, quote-unquote, and accusing another of working for communist guerrillas. Results for municipal and city workers and city mayors, rather, and councils are expected within hours of polling closing at 6 p.m. Monday night, with winners of the Senate and congressional seats likely to be declared from Friday onward. Mm-hmm. Now, even if the presidential term limit is not lifted, the Duterte family looks well-placed to continue its reign. The president's daughter, Sara, being eyed by some as the president's potential successor in the 2022 vote, is running to keep her post as a mayor in its southern bailiwick of Davao City. Her younger brother, Sebastian, is seeking unopposed the city's vice mayoral seat, while Duterte's eldest son, rather, Paolo, is standing for a seat in the lower house of representatives. Electoral contests in the Philippines have always been bloody. Dozens, including candidates and their supporters, are killed in the fierce competition for posts, which are a source of wealth in a country with deep poverty. And police are on high alert to safeguard balloting as the bloody trend continued this year, with 20 killed and 24 wounded in election-related violence in the run-up to the vote, according to an official count. So we'll see where all that goes. It's going to be very, very compelling, that's for sure. Now let's quickly go over to see what else is going on. This is interesting because something's happening in Lithuania. Evidently, Lithuania is going to vote in a runoff, actually, over the defeated prime minister who has quit. So an economist and political novice, Gitanas Nauseda, took the lead in the first round of Lithuania's presidential election on Sunday. He's going to face Ingrida Simonyte, a conservative ex-finance minister, in a May 26 runoff in the Baltic Eurozone state. Center-left premier Saulius Skvernelis vowed to quit in July after he was eliminated from the runoff, having come in third place, conceding that, quote, the failure to get into the second round is an assessment of me as a politician, Skvernelis told public broadcaster LRT that he would tender his resignation. Now, Seda, promising to seek the political middle ground and build a welfare state, scored 31.07% of the vote, according to near-complete official results. I want to thank all of the people who took to their hearts our message that he wanted a welfare state in Lithuania and we want more political peace. Nauseda told reporters in Vilnius, that's the capital, 54-year-old is seeking to bridge the growing rich-poor divide in the former Soviet Republic of 2.8 million people, which joined the European Union and NATO back in 2004. Now, Seda has a greater chance to attract votes that went to other candidates, especially from the left. Vilnius University analyst Ramūnas Vilip Isaukas. In all, nine candidates ran in the first round. In second place, Simonyte, who is popular with wealthy, educated urban voters, generated or garnered 28.73% of the vote, while resonating with the rural poor. Srenelis' popular approach took 21.24% support, with returns from 99.27% of polling stations officials' results showed. Simonyte is 44, he's a technocrat, who also warns against deepening inequality and the urban-rural divide, and has vowed to reduce it by boosting growth further. Socially liberal Simonyte supports same-sex partnerships, which stir controversy in the predominantly Catholic country. Simonyi said she would resist populism during her second round campaign and seek support from political forces, quote, with consistent views that do not try to be on the right with one leg and the left in the other. Lithuanian presence, steer defense and foreign policy, attending European Union and NATO summits, but must consult with the government and the prime minister on appointing the most senior officials. A popular incumbent president, Dalia Grybauskait, an independent in her second consecutive term, must step down due to term limits. Politician nicknamed the Iron Lady for her strong resolve has been tipped in as a contender to be the next president of the European Council. Both Naseda and Simonyi are strong supporters of European Union and NATO membership bulwarks, as bulwarks against neighboring Russia, especially since Moscow's 2014 military intervention in Ukraine. Analyst Vilpišauskas said that both Noseda and Simonyi are very likely to opt for continuity in foreign and defense policy. With Noseda, there can be some tactical change when it comes to communicate with the neighbors, but the strategical line is unlikely to change. So that seems to be the story there. And that's where we're going to end our day with you. I want to thank you for being with us today. Let me quickly look to see who we're having tomorrow. Oh, this is going to be really fascinating. We'll speak to Robert Keston, the hyperlocal political analyst, and also with Commissioner Clyde Isley, who's running for mayor in the city of Mount Vernon. So he'll be on at 10:30. And then we'll do a little bit of international news from 11 o'clock to 12 if there's enough news to talk to you about. So that's the story. So Robert Keston, Commissioner Clyde Isley, hopefully you'll consider joining us. All right, so there we have it, folks. Let me just go back to our studio screen. Here we are, and wish you a great day. Bye.